And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. And this hour, we visit with journalist and author Jeff Klinkenberg. He grew up in Miami, worked for the defunct Miami News as a teenager, and he's written for the St. Pete and Tampa Bay Times for, well, quite a spell. His latest University Press of Florida volume is Alligators in B-Flat, Tales from the Files of Real Florida. And he joins us from St. Pete. Hello, Klink. Welcome back.
Hello, sir. How are you?
Very well.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. First, before I ask you my first question, I just want to say that these portraits are so vivid and sensitive, and so many of them touch my heart, you know, so I want to thank you for that. They're beautiful.
Well, thanks for saying that, and if you want to repeat that, go ahead.
Joe has something to say.
What about the shortages of stone crabs we just heard about?
I'm very sad about that, you know. Doggone.
Anyway, to your book, how do you find these people? Do you seek them out? Do they seek you out? Is it both, or do you discover them in your travels?
Well, it's all of those things. I do. I travel from Pensacola to Key West, so I do stumble across people. I see something. I grew up here, so I have a pretty good sense of place. I know what belongs, and I know what doesn't belong. So sometimes I'll see one of those things, and I'll just I'll stop and check it out, and it turns out to be a good story. I am one of those people who thinks that all of us have a story to tell, and sometimes I'll stop and I'll chat with someone, and they'll say, "Well, why do you want to talk to me? You know, I'm boring, or I've got no story to tell." But most of us really do. With the internet, though, I have many people from all over the state who will suggest something, and sometimes they pan out in a big way, sometimes not, but I'm always grateful when somebody calls me. And there's always, you know, I'm listening to National Public Radio, I'm reading the news, so I'm always wondering, you know, how to relate maybe a grassroots Florida stories to kind of a larger national story. So I know you've talked to other writers before, other newspaper writers, and the truth is, I mean, we're always working even when we're not.
Right.
We're always thinking about it.
Jeff, you grew up in Miami. What area and what schools?
My parents moved to Miami in 1951 when I was two, and that was northeast Miami in an area just outside of Miami Shores on the Biscayne Canal. So,
would that be Biscayne Park?
Yeah, near Biscayne Park.
Famous for
Miami
speed traps.
Shores, near North Miami, some in a kind of an unincorporated Dade. And I went to St. Rose of Lima elementary school, which is still there. And then I went to Archbishop Curley for a couple years. And then I finally graduated from Miami Edison. Went to Miami-Dade North for a couple years and then transferred to the University of Florida.
And what's this business that you worked at the Miami News at age 16?
Well, I was one of those kids, one of those lucky kids, I guess, who from the time I was little, I knew I wanted to be a writer. And I knew I wanted to be a Florida writer when I was a kid because I was very interested in the outdoors and fishing and all those things. But my parents were big newspaper writers. They were not big book or newspaper readers. They were not big book readers. So they always had the newspapers out, and of course they read the Herald and they read the Miami News too. And they really loved the Miami News. It was kind of feisty and colorful. And when I was in high school, I was the sports editor of the Miami Edison Herald, and I would call the high school editor at the Miami News for pointers or whatever. And when I was 16, he said, "Well, why don't you come on in and you can answer the phones for us?" So I started doing that when I was 16.
And then when did you get hired as a columnist? Or was it a sports writer?
When I graduated from the University of Florida, I did come back to Miami, and I was like the high school prep editor. And that was in the early 1970s. And then I left. I was in Fort Lauderdale for a while. I covered the Miami Dolphins. And then I went back to the news to write about the outdoors. And a lot of people said, you're crazy. You know, you've been covering professional football. That's the big celebrity, high-profile beat if you're a newspaper reporter, if you're a sports writer anyway. But to me, I wanted to tell stories of real people. I wanted to hang out with people, and that was impossible if you were covering professional sports. So I kind of liked the, you know, spending a day with a fisherman or go out in the glades and stuff. So I was doing that in my 20s, and then eventually I came up to the St. Pete Times in 1977 to kind of pursue what I do now, which was to broaden the thing from just the outdoors to Florida culture in general. And, yeah, can I go on?
Yeah, please.
Let me tell you, Florida has always had writers who interpret the state for readers. And in the 18th century, there was a guy named William Bartram, who was from Pennsylvania, who came through the South, but he spent a lot of time in Florida writing about the flora and the fauna and the native people who lived here and the rough-and-tumble settlers. And that book is still in print. It was a hit, mostly in Europe. And in the 19th century, you had Harriet Beecher Stowe, who, of course, had written Uncle Tom's Cabin, who sort of got tired of her celebrity and bought a place in Florida up near the St. John's River. And for 18 winters, she lived up there, and she wrote about Florida, too. And, of course, in the 20th century, you had people like Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings and Zora Neale Hurston and Marjorie Stoneman Douglas also writing about Florida. And then when I was a boy growing up in Miami, the Miami News had this fantastic columnist born in Plant City, a guy named John Kiesler.
Sure.
And though he didn't write about Florida with a capital F, he was a true Floridian, and he was just writing what it was like in a very humorous way, what it was like to live in South Florida. And the Herald had a couple of really good ones, too. One was Nixon Smiley.
Yes.
And then the other, who was a real hero to me, and I wouldn't call him a mentor, but he certainly encouraged me along the way, a guy by the name of Al Burt. And so by the time I was a young journalist, a professional journalist, I wanted to be Al Burt when I grew up. And Al eventually retired, and he encouraged me to kind of keep it up, keep writing the Florida culture stories. And now I kind of feel like I'm an endangered species. You know, just some of the things that have happened to newspapers due to the economy and the new the challenges of online, somebody like me is a luxury. So to write about the things I do. So I'm lucky, you know, that the Tampa Bay Times still has a place for me and lets me tell these stories.
Really?
About Florida.
You write about others' passions. Is that one of the, and that's one of the reasons the stories are so moving to me, but is that a quality that often attracts you to these people, their passion for whatever it is?
It is, exactly, yeah. And I think it's probably true for other writers, too. But just thinking of some of the stories I have in the book, there's one, it's one of my favorites, favorite profiles of all time. It's called Thunder Man.
Mm.
And it's about a guy that called me up one day to talk about thunder. And he was one of those people who calls and doesn't want to let you go. And so finally I had to break the, I said, well, give me your name and your phone number and whatever. And he called the next day. And it was like thunder was the only thing that mattered to him. And what he wanted to do was, he recorded it. And he had all these recordings of thunder. And it turned out he was blind since he was a baby. And I'm not a psychiatrist, a psychologist, but I think he had, Asperger's. So he had some social challenges. But I spent a lot of time with him over in Tampa. As a writer, I try to kind of immerse myself into that person's life, and you try to figure out where they're coming from. And he did. The story published, and I, for months and months and months, I would hear from him, sometimes too often, because as far as he was concerned, the most important thing on earth was thunder and the study of thunder, and couldn't quite understand other people who didn't share his views. So, I try to write a piece about him that really had some compassion for the way he is.
That was a beautiful piece, and the part about his father was very sad, I thought. It was a very sensitive depiction, though.
Yes, he had some, and you think back to what it must have been like for his parents, too. Back at a time when autism and Asperger's really wasn't understood, and you've got this kid, and all he wants to do is listen to thunder and talk about thunder. I'm sure it drove his parents mad, who I'm sure wanted the best for their kid,
Right.
But just couldn't handle it and made things worse. You always hope, writers do anyway. You start out with this one idea for a story. Oh, here's a guy who likes to record thunder. And that's enough to get me out there because it's just kind of interesting. And then when you go out there, you see that there's just so much more to it. There's that the whole human condition. There's something deep there that you have to think about. So when I talk to, I'm 64, and so when I talk to younger writers, I tell them, there's two stories. There's kind of the obvious story, and then there's the deep story, and your best stories, you'll know what the deep story is if you do enough reporting.
Right. We're speaking with Jeff Klinkenberg. He's an award-winning journalist at the Tampa Bay Times, and the name of his latest book is Improbable Tales from the Files of Real Florida. Alligators in B-flat. Improbable Tales from the Files of Real Florida. How could I forget that? And we need to take a short break. Stay with us, and we'll be right back.
And we return, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Jeff Klinkenberg, today's topical currents here on WLRN. If you'd like to join in with a comment or a question, easy enough, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, email, that's radio at WLRN.org,
and we have Twitter now, which is @topicalcurrents, and we'll get your tweets.
Jeff Klinkenberg, Alligators in B-flat. Tell us the story behind that.
That's the name of the title essay in there. And, some of the stories in this collection are pretty serious. But that one was, I think, me still kind of being this wide-eyed Florida boy. And the story is, I was listening to National Public Radio one morning in, 2007, and there was this wonderful science story about the note B-flat in nature. And the story was that black holes in outer space supposedly emitted this low B-flat tone that we wouldn't be able to hear if we were up there because it was too low. But I guess these scientists and their instruments had been able to pick out this low B-flat. And this reporter mentioned in passing that there was this old paper from the Museum of Natural History in New York City of somebody discovering by accident that male alligators could be kind of thrown into their mating bellowing by the tone B flat. And the story was, and I managed to get that study, or I got the paper, was was that somebody in a basement where there were some alligators in cages had accidentally hit some pipes with a monkey wrench. And suddenly these alligators started to bellow and growl. And this guy said, huh, what's that? Let's try it again. And it happened again. And then somebody came down and found out, well, this is a low B-flat. So there it was in this paper. As you know, though, if it can't be replicated, it's not considered real. It's considered more random. But anyway, someone did this paper in the 40s, and I got my hands on it after I'd heard this story on the radio. So one day, sitting at my desk, and I make this phone call, and Bill Mickelson, a guy named Bill Mickelson, picks up my phone call. And I said, Bill, I said, I know you're the principal tuba player at the Florida Orchestra. I also know that you have a master's degree from Yale in music, and you've played on CDs. I know you're a very serious musician. And he says, yes, that's right. And I said, but I got this question for you. What's that? I said, how would you like to go to Gatorland with me and play your tuba for a bunch of alligators? And he said, yeah! It was like the... I'd ask him the question that he'd always wanted to be asked. So we went out there to Gatorland, and Gatorland is this old Florida attraction near Orlando. It's been there since 1947, I want to say. It's old Florida. It's this great place. And so Bill and I, and he had this student, he had a protege from the New England Music Conservatory who went with us, a young guy. And so we went to this place, and the curator of alligators there, an old-timer named Tim Williams, said, well, this is interesting. I don't think it'll work, but let's give it a go. And so I had these two tuba players standing at what they call the breeding marsh there, and they aimed their tubas out there, and they started to toot and toot and toot. And initially, like, nothing happened. And these tuba players just were sweating profusely. I had no idea that playing the tuba was such a physical enterprise. Because in the orchestra, they only play, you know, four or five notes, and then they'll rest for a while, and then 10 minutes later, you know, they'll play four or five notes. But I was asking them to play this B-flat, 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 and nothing was happening. But then after about 10 minutes or so, 15 minutes ago, the alligators started to change their behavior. They were all looking at us. And then we started to see some territorial displays between males where they were, like, taking bites at other males. And then we saw a female climb on top of a male and try to dunk him, which is part of mating season. If she can dunk him, he's not boyfriend material. Kind of like what you would see at the bars on South Beach. but if she can't dunk him, he's a macho gator, and he may be okay. So we saw that. But we weren't getting this bellowing, this famous lion-like bellowing. So Bill Mickelson, my tuba player, said, I wonder if we can get a little closer but still be safe. And what they finally did was they aimed the bell of the tuba down and in some cases put it on the deck, the boardwalk that went around the pond. And when they did that and started playing B-flat, the whole place exploded with bellows.
Did you record it?
We recorded it, and we put it on a video, and it was on our website for a while. They took it off, but we're going to put it back on soon so people can actually see this happening. It was one of the great videos of all time, in my opinion, as a Florida swamp boy. But what alligators do, the males, during mating season, they inhale, and they sort of arch their backs so their noses are pointing in the air, and then they exhale. And initially, there's no sound, but there must be this low frequency because the water flies off their necks like smoke. And that's followed by this tremendous Jurassic Park quality roar. Mm. And lots of people in Florida have heard it. If you live near a lake or a river, you'll hear it. But it's very unusual to see it, and it was like a one in a million thing to see it right in, see it like 5 feet in front of you. So once we got them going, we stopped. My tuba players stopped playing and gave it a rest, and then came back and played again notes other than B flat, and nothing happened. And they would go back to that low B flat, two octaves below middle C, and it would happen again. And then we stopped for about 90 minutes, had lunch, gator bites, if I remember, and then went to a different area of the park where it was thick with tourists, and they saw something that they got more than their money's worth to see these serious musicians walk out on the boardwalk with their tubas and start to play, and these alligators just answering like thunder. And there was this great moment where the young student, the guy from New England, he's kneeling, he's actually lying on the deck, so his mouth can reach the mouthpiece of his tuba, and he's blowing, and I'm looking at him, and I think, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. I'm going to take a picture of this. So I walk up there with my Nikon, and I'm about, I don't know, 5 feet away from him, and suddenly the deck starts to vibrate under my feet, followed by this bellow that sounds like the T-Rex is coming through the wood. I took off. I just started running. I couldn't help myself. And this poor young guy from New England sees me, the expert, run. He just flies out of there. It's like a horror movie. I mean, he's tripping and falling. And then I stopped and laughed and kind of crawled back and looked through the slats of the boardwalk. And there were like three enormous alligators right underneath where he had been playing the tuba. And it was like they were saying, all right, you know, where is she? She's got to show herself right now. So it was just this great moment. So anyway, our story published and our video went online and heard from crocodilian experts all over the world who had seen this study and maybe had given a kind of a half-hearted try, but, you know, never thought that anybody would be kind of nutty enough to try it with a real tuba player. So it was just one of those great Florida stories.
We're speaking with Jeff Klinkenberg. He's a journalist for, what is it, 36 years? I'm just trying to get the number. 36 years at the Tampa Bay Times?
Yes, and, before you were born.
Right. Alligators in B-flat, Improbable Tales from the Files of Real Florida. If you want to join in the conversation on Topical Currents, the number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, or email is radio@WLRN.org, or you can tweet us at Topical Currents. I loved the story of Jarhead, but I have a question for you about it. I'd like you to, it reads like a suspense tale, actually. But I didn't understand why that man, Mike Orlando, who manages the bears for the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission, kept euthanizing the bears. I mean, there were several instances where you're writing and he euthanized them when they hadn't attacked anybody.
Well, in some cases, they usually knock them out to just move them. But in some cases, these bears have become so habituated to people and to neighborhoods that they feel that it's safer to take them out of circulation. Similarly, and of course, people argue about this all the time, and I understand it, what they do with alligators, where, you know, alligators that have been fed either accidentally or on purpose sometimes lose their fear of people. So they'll continue to, you know, come into people's yards and stuff. And in the case of bears, and, you know, when I was a kid, I mean, you didn't see that many bears. You didn't hear about bears simply because they were in the what we would consider the wilderness. And now, because Florida is so big, our population is so large, you have two things. You have wildlife populations that are increasing because of the Endangered Species Act and protection of habitat. So all those things have worked, but at the same time, you know, the population grows, so people kind of now live in bear habitat and crocodile habitat and panther habitat. So you have more encounters between the big animals and people. So it's one of the sad things, in my opinion, about the bear comeback is that some of them, they have no idea what to do with them. I mean, zoos don't want them. If they put a 500-pound bear, take it 20 miles away and let it go, it may come back. And there have been a couple of instances already in Florida now where people have been not exactly attacked, but there have been these misunderstandings, I'll put it that way, between people and bears. In one case, an elderly woman hearing something on her patio at night, switching out her light, and she saw a couple bear cubs on her patio. So she goes out there. She's going to, like, she doesn't know how they got in there, but she's going to open the screen door so they can escape. And they're, like, they're bleating, you know, they're crying. And she steps out, and what she didn't know, Mama was there, too, eating from the dog's dish or the cat's dish. So, you know, Mama swatted her on her way out. So it wasn't a situation. And that bear, I don't believe they caught. But the one that I write about in that story, Jarhead, and Jarhead, by the way, was a cub that had gotten into some garbage and somehow put its head into a big pickle jar, and it got lodged in that jar and did not suffocate. I guess there was a little bit of air in there, but for 2 weeks, this little cub was running with his or her siblings and Mama, and the biologists were spending a lot of time and effort to try to catch those bears so they could take the pickle jar off of Jarhead. But in writing that, I also wrote about, and I was trying to explain what's going on with bears and humans in this place where they're colliding. And there was a woman one night in a suburb, not unlike Coral Gables, except surrounded by woods. And so she's in her house. She's just cooked. She's put her toddler to bed. She's sitting in her living room. The lights are out except the glow of the TV, and she's got her feet up, and she's got her, she thinks her dog is out in the yard. Well, anyway, she's watching TV, and the door that's been ajar so that her dog can go in and out suddenly creaks in. And she says, whatever the dog's name, Pepe, is that you? Quiet. Then there's that, the door creaks again toward her, And she looks down, and her dog is next to her. So something is pushing that door. So I don't know if I could have done this, but she gets up, and she tiptoes to that door, and she swings it open, and she doesn't see anything at first. And then she looks down, and there's the head of an enormous bear is creeping into her doorway. So she just slams the door on this bear, calls her dad, who lives next door. He comes running over with a flashlight. The bear is gone. But they see how it came into the yard. It squashed down this chain-link fence. Its weight was so great, the fence is like dented in the direction of the ground. And he continues to flash the light, and the back fence, which is wooden, has a hole in it like a Volkswagen Beetle had gone through. So this bear had fled that way. And so, you know, the state biologist considered that one a serious one, a bear, you know, sort of almost getting into somebody's house. And it took them a couple days, and they did catch it. And it was about 500 pounds in a neighborhood. So that one, as I recall, they did put down.
Right.
So that's sad. I'm not sure what the answer is.
Yeah, I was, I don't know. It just seemed like some of them hadn't really done anything, you know, to deserve to be put down. But you write about so many people and places that are kind of obscured from view. Would you say that most of us don't look carefully enough, or we don't appreciate what's right in front of us?
You know, I would say that's like generally true. And I have this advantage of traveling all over the state. So when someone tells me, well, you know, Florida's disappeared or whatever, you know, I don't quite wince because, boy, there are a lot of things that have changed. But there are lots of amazing places and sites that are still out there. And I have a section in my book called Some Places I Like to Go. And they have, in that section, are those places that are relatively unchanged, at least in my lifetime. And several of them are in South Florida. Joni's Blue Crab Cafe out on the Tamiami Trail. A place where, speaking of bears, I guess about 8 or 9 years ago, I was there in the late afternoon in the early spring, starting to get dark, but I'd gone in there to eat a lima bean stew. I mean, it's an old kind of an old cracker food. And I don't even like it, but I just like the idea that someone was still serving it. So I go in there. When I go to Joni's, that's what I eat. So I'm sitting at the table, and there's like no air conditioning. I mean, it's just screen doors and the breeze kind of going through there. And I'm eating lima bean stew, and there's a commotion at the back door. And so I got up. Other people were looking out there, and there was a bear back there. So that was, I don't know, maybe, what, 70 minutes from the Miccosukee Casino on Chrome Avenue and the Tamiami Trail. So there you had kind of modern Florida and old Florida kind of in a glance.
How about another area or another story in our area in West Palm Beach, Robert Hazard and the 1928 Hurricane Graveyard?
I'm very interested in history, and of course, always interested in African American history. And you know, I wanted to write about that particular hurricane, the famous 1928 hurricane. And it's hard to do it. And the 1928 hurricane went through West Palm Beach, and then it went across the state and across Lake Okeechobee. And there's a big dike now, 30 foot. It's called the Herbert Hoover Dike that surrounds the lake. And it wasn't there then. There was just a little berm. And so it flooded, and thousands of people drowned. And many, if not most, were African Americans. And the white victims, for the most part, were picked up and, you know, brought to an area where they could be identified. But that wasn't true of many of the black victims. Some of them from other countries. They were just either burned or they were taken to West Palm Beach, and bulldozers dug a pit and just dumped the bodies there. And there those bodies lay for 60, 70 years. And Robert Hazard, not born in Florida, I want to say he was from California, but very interested in Florida history, had met a couple of old-timers who told him about that. And so he started looking for the mass grave. And I don't think he'd mind me saying this, raising hell about it. Why isn't there at least some marker here? And it took him a while, and finally the Palm Beach got interested in it too. And finally, you know, somebody went out there with equipment and located with sonar this location of bones. So there is a park now dedicated to those storm victims. And, you know, that's and there's historic photographs and other things in the Museum of History there. So,
where is the park?
It's in West Palm Beach. It's not that far from downtown. And Robert likes to go there every day and kind of walks around the park. And there's an area that has a fence around it, and inside that fence is where a lot of these bodies are buried. Zora Neale Hurston, one of the great Florida writers, also wrote about that hurricane in her novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God, which also inspired Robert. But the sort of the climax of that novel takes place around Lake Okeechobee, where all these black farm workers are gathering in homes and climbing in attics, not unlike what happened with Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, as the water rises and these people are going into their attics and hoping it won't rise any farther, any higher. And in some cases it did. And anyway, thousands of people were killed. It was Florida's big natural disaster.
We're speaking with Jeff Klinkenberg. He's a journalist and an author, and his latest book is Alligators in B-Flat, and it's Topical Currents. One more short break, and we'll be right back.
And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Jeff Klinkenberg, and we're talking about his book, Alligators in B-Flat. Jeff, we've spent a lot of time on alligators, but how about Julie Harder? She's a grandmother and a state alligator trapper, and boy, I wouldn't mess with her.
She is a substantial woman. And when I wrote about her, and this still may be true, she was the only state-registered alligator trapper who was a woman. And so I heard about her and called her up. And this is one of those stories where you don't know a whole lot about it except, oh, here's a woman trapping alligators. So that's what brings you out there. And her territory is Hillsborough County, where Tampa is. And so I went out there and spent a couple of days with her. And then you find, you know, out this this backstory. In her case, her husband had been the alligator trapper in Hillsborough, and he had been killed, not by an alligator, but another accident. And during her period of mourning, the state asked if she wanted to replace him. And she had a little experience, but not a whole lot, but, you know, she did so. And so she's not only a grandmother, a mother, a grandmother, but she also is a counselor at a school in Lakeland. So, you know, at 3:30, she comes home and she changes from her dress and stockings into jeans and a T-shirt and gets into this pickup truck and you know, goes where she needs to catch alligators. And in some cases, you know, in the spring when alligators are amorous and wandering, I mean, she might get them from under a car in an apartment complex to, you know, in lakes, in developments. And these are alligators that that are showing up in places. In some cases, they've been fed, so they're up on lawns and whatever. So anyway, I spent a couple, three days kind of hanging out with Julie, watching what she did, listening to her, traveling, going with her to the cemetery where she visits her husband's grave, just trying to understand what makes her tick.
You know, I'm just wondering about you. You write about there's so many people that you write about, the swamp people and the glades people and Thunder Man and Flip Flop Man and George Serra, the Save Florida, Eat an Iguana person. I'm just wondering, and so many of your characters are not even of this century, are you more comfortable with them than say, on South Beach or in Starbucks, or where's your comfort?
Well, I'm a city rat, but I'm also a country mouse. I would say that's very true. I'm going to be in Coral Gables, for example, Saturday afternoon at Books and Books to do a talk and sell my book, and I love to go there.
That's the Coral Gables one? The Coral Gables one. The Coral Gables one, right?
Yeah, the Coral Gables Books and Books.
And so that's that's at 4:00.
Yes, so I love doing that, but at the same time, on the way home, I am going to be loving driving on the Tamiami Trail, and I might even, you know, drive off the trail and take my favorite road in Florida, which is the Loop Road, which is this 29-mile unpaved road that starts in the Miccosukee Reservation and loops into Monroe County. I mean, the Florida Keys County. There's a section of Monroe County that's on the mainland, and I'll go into there, and I've got some old friends there that are definitely from, I wouldn't say they're from the 20th century, they're from the 19th century.
Right.
And I will enjoy seeing them and hearing what they have to say and seeing what they're up to. So I kind of like, I like both of them, and I definitely do like my Starbucks coffee.
Okay.
Where is this Joni's Blue Crab Cafe?
It's in Ochapee. It's near where the smallest post office in the United States is.
Oh, yeah.
If you were driving from Biscayne Boulevard, US 1, it's probably about 80 miles west, maybe less than that.
On the trail?
On the trail. It's probably about, 40 miles west of of Chrome Avenue. Mm-hmm. But it's a place that's been there a long time. I mean, she and her husband used to have a gas station. It's a place where she has all these swamp recipes. One time I was there, I told you about the bear at her backyard, in her back door, but she, you know, she was kind of showing me around, and she opened a freezer, and she had a dead cottonmouth in there, a water moccasin, and all curled up. I said, "Well, what's that?" And she said, "Oh, the cook wants to try that sometime." Probably wasn't going to serve it to the public, but they're going to just try it, see what it tasted like. So, you know, you're not going to get that at South Beach.
No, you're not. I'm just interested. I don't know if you ever did meet Bunny Yeager, but in general, do you follow up with the people you meet after you write about them?
Yes, very often I do. And Bunny Yeager, as old Miamians will remember, she was the great, in the 50s, she was a great model and sun, you know, a bathing beauty who later turned to photography, and she discovered Bunny Yeager. And when I was a kid, a teenager especially, living in, by then we lived in Miami Shores, Bunny Yeager lived somewhere in Miami Shores. Now, we boys did not know where, but there were always, you know, bunny sightings. And because she was so tall and beautiful, we all had a crush on her.
Right.
Which I never kind of outgrew. So a few years ago, I heard that she was still alive in her 80s. And so I thought, well, you know, she's quite the Florida icon, and I'd love to write a story about her. And, you know, I started to call her, and I could tell she thought I was a stalker. And so we had these conversations on the phone, usually with her putting me off. Finally, she admitted that she was going to have an art exhibit in Miami, and then I might come to that and meet her. Right. So I did.
And that's very interesting. Yeah.
She didn't show. So, but it turned out, you know, I kind of liked writing about her not showing. It was sort of like, you know, the big one, the big fish that got away. So, but I have talked to her since then.
Oh.
Well, you hear the music, Jeff.
So if you want to hear the end of that story, I think you have to come to Books and Books. And
oh, nice tie-in. Nice job.
Nice. Saturday at 4 o'clock, Books and Books, Jeff Klinkenberg. And the name of his book is Alligators in B-Flat, Improbable Tales from the Files of Real Florida. He's an award-winning journalist of the Tampa Bay Times. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you much.
And that wraps up today's edition. Topical Currents is produced by Richard Ives. Technical direction from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Tomorrow's program begins with Miami-based author Michael Largo. He always writes about oddities. The latest, The Big Bad Book of Beasts, the world's most curious creatures. Mosquitoes smell humans 100 feet away. An adult elephant can eat some 500 pounds of plant per day. And just what makes a fox cunning. Also, Linda Gassenheimer's Food and Dining. Of course, we have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. And there's more information at the Topical Currents website. Now our From the Sublime to the Ridiculous calendar for today. On this day in 1886, 127 years ago, the death of poet Emily Dickinson in Amherst, Massachusetts, age 56. A noted gardener, she studied botany from the age of 9. And on this day in 1902, 101 years ago, the birth of Chicago Mayor Richard Daley, who served from 1955 until 76. Talk about the strong mayor form of government. One more before we resort to cheap tricks. On this day in 1974, 39 years ago, the Frank Zappas announced the birth of their third child, Ahmet Rodan Zappa, named after the Japanese movie monster. Our theme music, created by Michael Levine. So we leave with a thought from the colorful senior mayor Daley, who served 6 terms, quote, "I resent insinuendos." Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.